Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And one thing that our president, George W. Bush, certainly does not want you to know is his past. There are all kinds of things, all kinds of secrets in George Bush's past that he rarely talks about. And it goes much beyond the National Guard. You probably do know that George W. Bush was AWOL from the National Guard. In fact, I think it might be a good idea if we just start calling him George A.W.O.L. Bush. He was absent without leave. But there's much more to that. Do you know about all his oil businesses and how every one failed until his daddy's friends came to bail him out, and sometimes he had to rely on his good friends, the Saudi Arabians? Do you know about his insider trading scam at Harkin, a scam so obvious that if his own lawyer hadn't been appointed by his father's SEC when his daddy was president, he likely, W that is, would likely be sharing a cell with Martha Stewart right now? Do you know about all his past arrests? Sure, we know about the two drunk driving arrests, although you may not know that his advisor Karen Hughes lied about them in print. But this guy was also arrested for fighting at a football game, for stealing a Christmas wreath as a prank. He also came home drunk one night, driving home, ran into some garbage cans, and threatened his father to a physical fight. But it's much more than these personal things. It has to do with his business. It has to do with following the money. Who are the people that put George W. Bush in power? Sometimes I think it is important to know someone's past, and with all the media focus on John Kerry's past, I thought it would be important to put two shows together, today and tomorrow, going into where these men running for president were 30 years ago. Tomorrow's show we're going to devote to John Kerry and actually play the entirety of a debate that John Kerry had with his arch nemesis John O'Neill, the guy that's still writing trash about him today, on the Dick Cavett Show. That'll be tomorrow. Hope you'll tune in for that. But today I want to talk about George W. Bush. And my guest, Mark Umeli, the author of Bush Unplugged, A True Patriot's Guide to George W. Bush, knows a lot about him. His book goes into the Vietnam years, the oil years, the years as Texas Ranger, the baseball guy, all the things that George W. Bush has done. And it really explores some of the candid moments that you might not have heard about in the mainstream press. One of the more interesting comments that George W. Bush said, that's certainly quoted in the book, is what he said back when he first began entering politics. He said, quote, "My biggest liability in Texas is the question, what's the boy ever done? He could be riding on daddy's name," unquote. Well, W's done a lot more than write on daddy's name. He's run on his brothers. He's run on big corporations. He's run on Enron. There's a lot of things that I think you need to know about so that when your Republican friends go and talk about John Kerry, tell them about George W. Bush's past. And I'd like to explore this hour. Not just the past, because, look, I recognize that people can change. I understand that. People who recognize their past and distance themselves from it, I have no problem with redemption. But I want to explore this hour how it is that George W. Bush really is the same partying frat boy, if you will, that he was 20, 30 years ago. Is he still relying on his daddy's allies and friends and money? Is he still the kind of guy who just always gets things his way because he's George W. Bush? Let's explore how it affects policy. And like I said, with that, I've got my terrific guest, Mark Umeli, author of Bush Unplugged, The True Patriot's Guide to George W. Bush, a book you can get on Amazon.com or great bookstores everywhere. And I also want to encourage you to call in. All you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com, or do as much as you always do, comment on the blog. Let's hear your comments. Here's your chance to find the inside scoop on George A.W.O.L. Bush. I'd like to welcome to my program Mark Umeli. Mr. Umeli, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, when did you first get involved in studying Bush's past?
Wow, that was back in the late 90s, around 97. Interestingly enough, I was working on a documentary for television based on hydrogen fuel cells as the energy alternative of the future. And I was also looking into the darker aspects of our energy future, and that's when I stumbled upon George W. Bush and his reckless record as Texas governor, where he had allowed his biggest campaign contributors from big energy, oil, gas, coal, chemical, agricultural, to come in and rewrite Texas environmental law to suit their needs. It looked like a really dangerous policy. It was absolutely shocking to me.
So this is nothing new here, allowing corporations that pollute, big energy corporations, to rewrite our laws. This is something he did as Texas governor.
That's right. And it was really, it was something new. It was really unprecedented. Look, we've always had massive influence from PACs and lobbyists and corporations on our government when they give politicians money. Sure, they held a big sway. That's why they give them money. But this was different. George Bush went so far as to allowing these characters to come into his administration and work hand in hand to rewrite 30 years of Texas environmental law. Now, the thing that really scared me, as someone who I'm a very dedicated outdoorsman, I'm a hunter, I'm a fisherman, and you know, wild places and the conservation are big issues with me. And when George Bush reared his ugly head and I found out he was running for president, I was about to do anything that I could to stop him, because I knew he'd be bringing the same foxes guarding the chicken coop type of policies to our national, on the national level. So, and it goes much further than that, and we could talk about that.
Why don't we start at the beginning? Because obviously he was governor of Texas later on in his life.
That's right.
And I want to get to that. Let's start at the very beginning. Your book opens with the Vietnam years, and it talks about how George Bush got into the Champaign unit of the Texas National Guard. And you told me in a pre-phone interview that you've got some information that you really think the Democrats should use that hasn't come out in the mainstream press. Tell me what you got.
Well, actually, the whole book, we'll get to the Texas Ranger, the Vietnam Wars in a second, but just let me say, the whole book, Bush Unplugged, is to come out with, I believe, to take this guy down, and I've proven that. I've converted many of my conservative friends just by sharing chapters of this book with them. The Democrats, for some reason, just do not know how to fight these battles, and they're letting the Republicans run all over them. And,
I think one of the differences is the Democrats don't like to fight dirty the way the Republicans do.
Well, like I say, the Republicans play to win, the Democrats play to tie.
Okay.
And if you're playing against someone who plays to win and you're playing to break even, you're going to lose every time. And welcome to George Bush's America, where all three branches of our government are run by not just the Republicans, by a right wing of the Republican Party, the neoconservative right wing.
Well, let's go into some of those things that you use to convince your conservative friends. I know many of my listeners out there, most of them, not all of them, but most of them are Kerry supporters, but they've got friends and family who are thinking about it, and some are dedicated Bush supporters. What did you tell your conservative friends to actually get them to change their mind about W?
I'll tell you what I do. I was doing experiments when I was writing the book. I have conservative friends all over the country, and I'm from Pennsylvania, which is a critical swing state, and I use them as my sample market. Now, what I did was I just evaluated their personalities. What is it that, where are their emotional hot buttons? Is it on corporate crime? Is it the war on terror? Is it the war in Iraq? Is it the economy? And I chose a chapter from the book. For instance, I have a good friend in Pennsylvania who really just hates, he's a big corporate bigwig, and he really hates corporate crime because he's been the victim of it. I emailed him my chapter on Bush and Enron, and he was just blown away. He had no idea the depths and the reach of the Bush-Enron connection, how long it's been going on, and just how buddy-buddy Ken Lay and George Bush really were. And his ability to distance himself from the whole Enron debacle. So that's just one example. If someone is a veteran, I let them read, cause, you know, Bush has a big lead over Kerry insofar as veterans are concerned.
Well, he does have a lead, but it's less than Republicans normally have over Democrats in that category.
That's right. But look at what's happening right now. This book came out bashing Kerry over his Vietnam War record.
Right.
And they respond by saying, oh, they're wrong. They should retract that. Well, if you would spell out to people exactly what happened when George Bush was in the National Guard, it really is pathetic, and nobody has really touched on some of the details that I think would really get to the male mentality and make them think, my God, what a punk.
Well, let's give some of those details out.
It's one thing. Listen, I have news for you, Mark. If I was in George Bush's place, I'm 45. I graduated high school the year Saigon fell. If I was in George Bush's place, I would have taken the same route that he took. I would have used my daddy's connections to get me out of the National Guard. However, I'm a man of character and integrity, and I think it would have humbled me somewhat, and I would have been in the position where I would have listened to, you know, our military leaders and advisors and the people of the world and advisors from all over the world and foreign relations officials and you name it, who came out and said, you know, you really need to rethink this Iraq war policy. But he was so hell-bent to go in there and prove that he was going to do a job that his daddy didn't finish. It really speaks to who he is. Let me just cover a couple of things that I talk about in Bush Unplugged.
Sure.
In 1968, right, Bush's number comes up for the draft board. He has to sign up in 10 days. At that time, there were between 250 and 300 soldiers dying per week in Vietnam. Now, there were over 1,000 guys applying for entry into the 100,000 guys applying for entry into the National Guard.
100,000.
100,000.
Okay.
The waiting list for admission into the Texas Air National Guard was 18 months long. Okay? Now, miraculously, Bush was accepted the same day that he applied. And there's no doubt about it that someone else's son, who waited his turn, lost out and went to Vietnam in George Bush's place.
And in fact, the unit he was put in was called the Champagne Unit.
That's correct.
Why was it called the Champagne Unit?
Because it was manned by politically connected sons of Texas elites and celebrity draft dodgers. I believe there was something like 7 Dallas Cowboys on that list, and the sons of Texas senators and congressmen from both the Democratic and Republican parties. So that was that was his parent unit. Now, just a few weeks, what's interesting, if the Democrats could make a commercial about what I just said, it would blow people's minds. I mean, nobody knows.
Well, MoveOn.org is just starting to make that kind of commercial. Interestingly, Kerry distanced himself from it, but I don't see why we can't run it, you know, to basically respond to the lies they've told about Kerry with truths about George W. Bush.
Just a few weeks after joining, he gets an 8-week leave of absence to go and work on a Republican campaign in Florida, of all places, a buddy of his dad's who is running for Republicans for the Florida Senate.
Now, I presume most of the ordinary grunts can't get these 8-week sleeves like that? Okay, I didn't think so.
No, because he was right in the middle of basic training.
In the middle of basic training,
right,
he got his leave.
Right in the middle of basic training. He didn't complete basic.
He never completed basic.
Well, he did complete basic, but in the middle.
In the middle, he had to go. I could just see that. Do 10 push-ups. 1, 2, 3. You know what, sir? I think I'd rather go work on a campaign.
Exactly.
Okay, so
he comes back and he completes basic training.
All right.
Now, then something miraculous happened. His commanding officer instantly approves him for something called a direct appointment. And that was a promotion to the rank of second lieutenant. Now, second lieutenant is a rank that was normally attained after completing 18 months of active duty, or 4 years of officer's training. How did he do it? Well, direct appointments were, let's say you go into the Army or any branch of the military, Mark, and you're a doctor. Okay, you have a special skill. What they do is they give you this directive. They give you a higher rank that commands a higher pay scale because you have a special training. You have a special skill that, that's very valuable to the military.
Right.
Bush had none of the above.
He just got it because, well, they knew his daddy, who was a congressman
absolutely.
At the time.
Now, he needed to get into flight school, so he needed that rank.
Here's one thing that I found in my investigation, and I did a whole story just on the Bush AWOL part back a few months ago. You can check that out on my internet site. But I found good, I appreciate that. I think some of my listeners have as well. One of the things that I was most interested in is that when he took the pilot aptitude test, it's a multiple choice test. There are four choices on the test, A, B, C, or D, and out of 100 questions, he got 25 right. Now, if you fill out the ovals randomly, you know, as a three-year-old, fill them out randomly, you don't have to know anything about flying, you will also get, on average, 25%. That's a shockingly low score. But it's just a little side point. Go ahead.
No, it's not, because that was the next point that I was going
to make. Oh, okay, all right.
I think it is really important, because, you know, first of all, he was promoted into flight school. It was a social promotion, really. He sort of failed upwards. That 25, by the way, was the lowest possible grade for admission.
Right.
So there's no question about it. There were other men, young men, who had scored higher grades that were left. Another man was left out because George Bush, you know, his dad was a very powerful congressman.
And in fact, it cost a lot to train him as a pilot, didn't
Absolutely.
It?
Now he also jumped over 150 other pilot applicants that were already standing in line in front of him, waiting for their chance to fly. So again, somebody else loses out, so George Bush can move forward. Now, in another serendipitous twist of fate, he was assigned to fly a plane called the F-102 Delta Dagger. Now, what's really interesting about that is that, you know, they don't have anything to really promote when it comes to his military record. And I know Rush Limbaugh likes to tell his listeners, oh, this Delta Dagger was a hell of a machine. It was a very, very, very difficult machine to fly. And our fearless leader was in there piloting that plane over his dad's Houston Congressional District. The interesting thing about the Delta Dagger is that all overseas F-102 flights were shut down completely just 3 months after Bush completed his flight training. And when he was assigned to the Delta Dagger, it was already being decommissioned. It was not never
so,
going to fly.
So just to be clear, did he choose to be in this plane rather than some other plane?
Who knows? He was assigned to it.
Okay.
I don't really think you choose your plane. What you do is you probably can put in a request.
Okay, so but he was assigned to a plane that was already in the process of being removed from any Vietnam theater.
From overseas service and had literally zero chance of ever flying over the unfriendly skies of Southeast Asia, Mark.
A great way to protect a congressman's son from ever having any danger.
Right.
All right.
Now, of course, there's no proof that he ever really showed up between 72 and 73. That came next.
Well, what's interesting, and again, we won't spend the whole show on his AWOL, but one of the things I find most interesting is that the reason he was decommissioned as a pilot, well, there were two reasons. One was because he refused to show up for a medical exam, which was the first exam ever that included a drug test. And I've read some statements, in fact, I have some on my blog, that suggest that, in fact, they were very concerned about pilots that were high on drugs, and that may be the reason why he was decommissioned. The other reason is, of course, he refused to show up, and on my website there's a number of direct orders that George Bush disobeyed when he ran off to Alabama for a political campaign.
Well, that's right, and, you know, we really never will know whether or not he did show up for that a flight exam.
I just find it ironic that Kerry has all these people saying and lying, saying, I serve with John Kerry. Everyone wants to prove they serve with John Kerry. It's just the opposite for George Bush. He says, where are the people that serve with me? And nobody shows up. It's kind of embarrassing. I do want to ask you this, though. I want to get, and then we'll move on after the commercial break to talk about other things George Bush has done. But let me read to you one of the emails I've already gotten that the listener writes, I'm going to go ahead and throw this out. I think it interesting all the Democrats are focusing on Kerry's war record and Bush's record. Does it really matter that much? Didn't all these people vote for Clinton, who avoided service over Bush Sr., who was a World War II vet? It didn't work for Bush Sr. Maybe we should not try to put all our eggs in this basket and instead talk about why we really think Kerry would do a better job than Bush. Let me respond to James, and then I'll give you a chance, Mark.
Okay.
My view, James, and the reason why I'm having Mark on my show is that sometimes someone's past does matter as an indicator of their future. One of the things about Bill Clinton is that he didn't show up, and a lot of men, as Mark pointed out, didn't show up, but he opposed the war. He didn't show up for a war that he disagreed with. Now, Kerry did one better. He actually showed up for a war he disagreed with. One of the things I find most interesting about George W. Bush is there's absolutely no record of any opposition of his to the war in Vietnam. In other words, he supported the war as long as other people went to fight it. And therefore, I think it is still relevant what he did and the fact that he didn't even show up for what he agreed to show up for, particularly as we come to a war in Iraq, where, again, there are other people's kids that are going to fight. But, Mark, I'll let you respond to that as well.
I couldn't agree more, and that's the point, that's the conclusion that I come to. I do want to say about why the first part of my book is called Bush 101, and it only takes, that's Bush's past as a businessman and this Texas Air National Guard business, it only takes up a third of my book. For those who are uninitiated, and that's who I wrote the book for, it really is important to understand where someone is coming from. If you're going to be able to factor this into the equation and determine how it is that he got here now, how he got us into this position as well, these are the things that shaped his attitudes. And it goes to what you were saying. His fortunate son status carried him from the Texas Air National Guard all the way to the White House. And it is this sort of social promotion and special treatment that he got that is emblematic of who George Bush is. A nice guy, but someone who never really had to develop a specific skill set and failed upwards all the way to the presidency. And that's why I start here and walk them right up into today's war.
We have to go to a commercial break, but I want to give you a chance to call in and ask your questions to our guest, Mark Umeli. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. Got a question about George W. Bush and his past? Who's really behind him? Where's the money coming from? What makes this guy tick? What does he care about? These are all questions that you can ask. Just dial toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, and we'll be right back after this.
It's time for another Gooberhead Award, presented periodically to those in the news who had their tongues going 100 miles per hour, but who forgot to put their brains in gear. Today's goober goes to Washington lobbyist Frank Keating. He's the former right-wing governor of Oklahoma who tried to get a top political job in the Bush regime, but ethical problems disqualified him. So Frank sank to a lower ethical strata, hiring on to hustle legislative favors for life insurance corporations. Appallingly, Frank recently stood up for several insurance firms that are engaged in a shabby insider deal to fleece young American soldiers who are on their way to war in Iraq. Often posing as military instructors in personal finance, insurance agents from these corporations have duped unwitting young troops into buying rip-off life insurance policies that are unneeded and nearly worthless. It's an abominable, totally unethical act of war profiteering. But here came Keating, the industry mouthpiece, to blame the victims. Someone who is mature enough to fight and quite possibly die for their country should be freely able to decide how much and what kind of life insurance they should have, he said. What a goober. He knows that this is not about free markets or free will. These low-ranking soldiers are set up for the insurance predators. The sales pitch often comes as part of compulsory military classes. The soldiers are not even told they're buying insurance, and many of the insurance agents are retired military officers. These 18, 19, 20-year-old soldiers, conditioned to obeying the commands of senior officers, believe that retired Colonel so-and-so is telling them something they must do, so they sign without questioning. This is Jim Hightower saying, yet Keating is still lobbying Congress to let his corporate clients continue picking the pockets of the underpaid grunts heading to Iraq. Is this the freedom they're being asked to die for? I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George V.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest, Mark Umeli, is the author of Bush Unplugged, a patriot's look into George W. Bush, and we're talking about the past of our current president and trying to figure out whether there are any past traits, things that happened in his past that can help explain the kind of president he is today. Tomorrow we're going to focus on John Kerry's past. And we've talked a decent amount about George Bush being AWOL in the National Guard. It's a story that's gotten a lot of attention. So I guess unless you have any final words on it, Mark, I want to move on and talk about some of his business.
Yeah, I do. I just want to answer something that goes to your last caller's question.
Sure, sure.
I think the great irony of Bush's war in Iraq is the thousands of National Guardsmen who should be home with their families, working their regular jobs, and serving in the interest of national security are serving extended tours of duty in Iraq, which is unprecedented in history. In the history of the National Guard, and I think all Americans should be aware of this. This is a guy who really got a pass, and he has no problem with sending the sons and daughters of less fortunates in the National Guard to go fight in a completely unnecessary war.
I got another comment actually here that I want to read. It says that one of the most interesting books he's read on Bush is called American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. He writes, what W is doing is not original. It's some of the same things his family has been doing for years. This book tracks the actions of his family for the past 100 years, and it is truly disturbing. W is just a creation of these years of corruption and pandering to the military-industrial complex. And then he writes, I will have to read this guest's book as well. Well, you should read it, because it really does go into a lot of detail. I want to go to a caller. You're on the line with Mark Levine and Mark Umeli. Caller?
Hey guys, how you doing? I'll make this quick because I'm losing my voice and I'm also at work.
But, okay, ask your question.
Is there any proof as far as records that he was arrested for drunk driving and or cocaine-related charges, as we hear so much about. And with that, I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you. Mark, you start, and then I'll finish.
Well, I'm going to have to leave that one to you, Mark.
Okay.
I did look into some of that, some of those issues. However, I decided that when I was going to write this book, I wanted it to have a nonpartisan appeal. So I decided to follow George Bush's money trail, and it goes through all the way through his connections with the Saudis and the Bush business affairs over the decades, as your other email listener said. So I do cover all those things, and I give the big, broad picture. But again, I wanted to talk about the money trail.
Okay, I want to get to the money trail. Let me just answer the listener's question as far as...
Money trail.
Okay, I want to get to the money trail. Let me just answer the listener's question as far as my understanding is, and then I also very much want to get to the money trail. It is true that he was arrested twice for drunk driving. It's also true that his advisor, Karen Hughes, lied about it in a piece on her in the New Republic during the campaign. She said he'd only been arrested for two other things, one for a fight at a... I think it was a football game. It was some sports event that broke out, and the other was for a fraternity prank for stealing a reef, so fighting and theft. But the drunk driving convictions, although they were hidden, they have been proved, both of them. As far as cocaine, George Bush will not say whether or not he has done cocaine. He's been asked about it. In fact, he hasn't been asked about it in this campaign hardly at all. He was asked about it once 4 years ago, said he would not discuss it. I'll tell you this. The time he went missing from the National Guard, had him home, hit some garbage cans, and he is doing community service in Houston. Now, it is extremely unlike, and we'll talk about this more with our guest, but it is not in George Bush's character or history at any time in his history, except for this six-month period, to do community service of any kind. Most observers that I've talked to believe he was ordered to do community service, most probably as a cocaine conviction. But at that time, you could get cocaine convictions expunged from your record. So there would be no record of it unless someone asked George Bush that question. If he were to lie about it, then maybe they could pull out an old record. But I think it's very interesting that at the same time he refuses to take a drug test for the National Guard, he's doing this community service in Houston, very much unlike George W. Bush. That was the kind of program that they put you in way back in the 70s. Today, George Bush supports putting people in jail for really 10 years for possessing the kind of cocaine that would have been common for him to use in the 1970s. The point is that he did this community service, and I'll tell you one last conversation on this, and I want to get to the money trail. I had a conversation personally with Matt Drudge at a radio broadcasters conference, and I asked Drudge, who likes bringing up all this dirt on everybody else, about the cocaine use. And he said to me, you know, 4 years ago, everybody said, who's going to bring up the cocaine use? Who's going to bring up the cocaine use? And I didn't want to do it. And it's very interesting that Drudge, who'll bring up all kinds of things, true and false, about Kerry, refuses to bring up the cocaine charge. Some investigative reporter might want to look into it, or I would prefer just some reporter ask George Bush point blank, why is it that you believe that people should go to jail for 10 years, which he does believe, just for using cocaine, when you yourself will not say whether you've used it? It's a question of hypocrisy. And one last point on this, the people that have done cocaine have committed a felony, and they can't vote for the rest of their lives in 13 southern states, including Florida. So I think it's a very fair question to ask whether George W. Bush should be voting or not. That's an extended answer to the question, but I do want to get back to my guest point, because the money trail is very important. And I'd like to know, I guess from the beginning, how did he get funded and who's been funding him as he's gone on in his early career?
Well, the thing that's interesting, here's the thing that made the big difference for George W. throughout his days in the Texas oil biz, which lasted roughly from 79 to 90. His
okay.
father was either running for president, serving as vice president under Reagan, or serving as president himself. So here you had the one of the most powerful men on the planet with world-class connections to institutional wealth, whose son became a veritable money magnet for power players looking to gain a leg up in a political dynasty. You know, Bush had a winning personality. He was great at playing the good old boys routine with the fat cats. By all accounts, his employees seemed to really like him. But none of this, Mark, really translated into any success at the pump. He ran three companies into the ground, and the fourth, well, we'll get to in a minute. There's something about George Bush and oil that just doesn't mix, as we're seeing now in Iraq. So even though he was the kiss of death when it came to finding oil and gas...
Well, now who gave him his money to... I mean, it takes a lot of money to start an oil company. These things aren't cheap.
Okay, his first company was called Arbusto.
Right, which is Spanish for Bush.
That's right. He went to his uncle Jonathan, who was a stock trader and connected to all sort of wealthy fat cats that were tied to the Republican Party and had been donors of George Bush Sr. And what he did was he gathered up about 70. His uncle hooked him up with 70. They were investment bankers, real estate moguls, you name it. And he got these guys to put in small bits of money.
Remind me to call that Uncle Bush about investing in my radio show, because
yes.
You know, I could use 70 rich investors. If only my father were president. That's the way to succeed in America. Anyway, go ahead.
Right.
Sorry.
So he raised about $4.6 million from these guys. Now his uncle Jonathan said. He said that all of the people that got involved in this business were people that, you know, it was no problem for them if they would afford it. And what they were looking
for. A million here, a million there. I mean, that's pocket change, right?
$500,000, $40,000.
Exactly.
All different. Okay. So, he runs Arbusto into the ground, right? He's about to go bankrupt. Another company comes in called Spectrum 7 Oil and Gas, and they were operated by two guys named William DeWitt and Mercer Reynolds. Two guys that would go on to become substantial campaign donors to Big Bush when he ran for president in '88. And while Senior was president, DeWitt would use Little Bush as a front man to buy the Texas Rangers baseball team, which made Bush a multimillionaire.
Now, let me ask you this, because I strongly believe there's no such thing as a free lunch. DeWitt and, you said Mercer was the other guy?
Yeah, Mercer Reynolds.
Yeah, oh, Mercer Reynolds. So DeWitt and Reynolds, I don't think they were just giving away free money. What were they getting in return?
Well, you're buying into it. Everybody knew that the Bush clan was going to be a political dynasty. They saw George Bush Sr., his career. He was vice president. He was going to be running for president. And he had two sons who, you know, word was out. These guys were going to be big shots. These guys, one of these guys was going to be president someday. So it's a no-brainer.
So what would they get back? I mean, would they get tax breaks? Would they get...
Well, for instance, Mercer Reynolds became U.S. ambassador to Switzerland under Bush 43.
Okay.
And he's now the Bush-Cheney National Finance Chairman.
Okay.
Okay. Mercer Reynolds, the third, he brought Bush in as the front man to raise a ton of money when they bought the Texas Rangers baseball team from a family friend of Bush. So, you know, as you go through the book...
So he made a lot of money on the baseball team by using little Georgie Bush. Okay,
that's
I just right. want to
so
make sure that...
When he bailed him out of his first oil company, and brought him into his oil company, Spectrum 7, propped him up as a front man, and sent him out to go raise more money. He made a good friend.
Okay. Well, I was concerned about DeWitt and Reynolds. I just wanted to make sure their investment was paid off, and it sounds like it was paid off handsomely. You know, I got to tell you, it used to be you could buy a congressman, a senator for about $1 million. Today, it's so much more expensive, and I just wanted to make sure that they got their money's worth. Okay, go
now,
ahead.
There was another oil company between Arbusto and Spectrum 7, and that was called Bush Exploration.
Okay.
That was his second oil company. Arbusto crashed. And what he did was he went out and he took Bush Exploration public. And what Bush found was that, when you're going into the public and looking for investment outside of the family circle of friends, real investors look at the bottom line. And he didn't raise anywhere near as much money.
Don't you hate that about real investors? Actually caring about the bottom line and profits and legal profits? I mean, it's such a waste of time and effort. I understand why he used Daddy's friends. Okay, go ahead.
Right. So he didn't raise anywhere near as much money as he thought he would. So James Baker, a college buddy of James Baker, was his college roommate.
Secretary of State?
He was this fat cat from Panama, came in out of nowhere and pumped $1 million into Bush's company. Now, the connections between the Panamanian and James Baker go back very deep. They're good friends, and you know he doesn't really surface again in anything that you can really put your finger on. And I don't even mention his name in the book because he's a very dodgy character, and I don't really think it was necessary to go there. However, because I am concerned about the health and welfare of my friends and family. However,
wow. I don't know that we should say any more about that, but
go
ahead.
So after his third company goes, so that goes under the down the tubes. The Spectrum 7 guys, they bail him out. Spectrum 7 goes down the toilet, and then comes Harkin Energy. Harkin Energy buys into Bush's oil company. They prop him up. They put him up on the board of directors. They give Bush and his partners $2 million in Harkin stock, and Bush, like I said, he gains a seat on the board and gets a $500,000 in stock for his trouble. Now, here's a guy that is just, he's invested none of his own money. Okay. He's failed three times, and now he finds himself on the board of Harkin. Now,
okay.
Here's what's interesting. Here's where some very interesting paybacks come into play.
Yeah.
Not long after Bush comes on the board of Harkin, this gazillionaire Saudi sheikh, and a lot of other Saudi sheikhs, they come on, they mysteriously pop up, and they buy into Harkin Energy.
So which sheikh is it? Let's get some names.
This guy's name is Abdullah Taha Bakish.
Abdullah Bakish, all
right. Bakish, yeah, I call him Sheikh Bakish. Okay?
Sheikh Bakish, all right, go ahead.
Yeah, he was a personal representative. Okay, as soon as he comes onto the board of Harkin Energy, George, this guy, Sheikh Bakish, he buys, I think, 11% of Harkin, all right? Soon after that, a personal representative of his was added to a small group of Arab-American businessmen who would meet periodically with President Bush, 41, and his national security advisor, Scowcroft, to discuss Middle Eastern affairs.
So what would they get? I mean, I always want to know. I got the quid. What's
okay.
the quo?
Okay, here's the quo. In 1990, in an unprecedented move that folks in the oil business had scratching their heads, Bahrain, okay, the Persian Gulf island emirate.
Right, it's a small island that has a lot of oil, that's an Arab
That's right.
All right.
Chose Harkin Energy for an exclusive offshore drilling.
Oh, look at that. Isn't that nice, the way that, you know,
no.
It's nice to remember your friends like
no,
that.
No, I dug up a Time magazine article from October 1991, and all of this stuff that I have in this book you can find in print somewhere if you're willing to look, where they question why Bahrain would stake its financial future on what they referred to as, quote, an obscure, money-losing company with no refineries and no experience in offshore oil exploration. Maybe it's all just sheer coincidence.
Maybe it's all just coincidence.
Yeah.
I mean, Bahrain, of course, doesn't have enough oil. They have to look in Texas, right?
No, that's right. Now, at the time, Big Bush was reported to have numerous business associates in Bahrain. And here's another good connection. Also, I point out that U.S. Justice Department later discovered that the Sheikh Bakish character was tied to this BCCI bank,
okay.
the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was an outlaw bank known to be funding Islamic extremist organizations and even Osama bin Laden himself.
Now wait,
I go into that later in my chapter.
Now let's talk about this, and then we've got to take one more commercial break. But because this is an extraordinary charge you're making there, and I'm sure you know that, and I'm no fan of the president. But
hold on, Mark. I'm not making a charge. I'm just saying that.
Tell us what you know.
Okay, I'm not making a charge. What I'm putting forth is here a documented fact.
Okay.
Now, did Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. know that Sheikh Bakish had ties to terrorist organizations? I would say no.
Okay,
but let's be clear. However, when you do business with these kind of characters,
yep.
Wait, listen, we've known the Saudis have...
Tell me this. What was the connection between Sheikh Bakish, the guy that's been bailing out George W. Bush, and Osama bin Laden? Do we know that? Is it funded through charities? How did it work?
Well, here's one point of reference.
Okay.
The Wall Street Journal tied Bush, tied Bakish in an extensive interview they did, investigative report that they did in 90 and 91, and they looked into the BCCI Bank, which was a criminal bank. I think it was they defrauded more investors for more money than any other bank in history. They also had ties to these extremist organizations. They were shifting money into these Islamic charities all the way back in the late 80s and 90s. They did later chart some of the money that went to the startup, where there were startup funds, really, for Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So Sheikh Bakish was a part of this bank. He had done a lot of business with them and with a guy named Bin Mahfouz. Now, I get into Bin Mahfouz later in the book. He was a guy who was directly related to bin Laden. He had married his sister, and he was caught directly handing money to bin Laden.
And what was Mahfouz's connection to George W. Bush?
Oh. Mahfouz had two sons that bought into the Carlyle Group at the urging of Bush Sr. Okay.
Explain to our listeners what the Carlyle Group was.
Carlyle Group is an international equity firm. Probably the largest private equity firm in the world. It's run by a lot of...
And what was Mahfouz's connection to George W. Bush?
Oh. Mahfouz had two sons that bought into the Carlyle Group at the urging of Bush Sr. Okay.
Explain to our listeners what the Carlyle Group was.
Carlyle Group is an international equity firm. Probably the largest private equity firm in the world. It's run by a lot of big-time Republican... politicos from the Reagan era, including John Major, who George Bush and James Baker toured the world after the first Bush presidency, money and bringing into the Carlyle Group. he brought in the Saudi bin Laden group into the Carlyle group, Bush, and he also brought in the two sons of bin Mahfouz, Khalid bin Mahfouz. Now, Khalid bin Mahfouz's eldest son was targeted by the U.S. Treasury Department for giving $30 million to Al-Qaeda.
Gave $30 million to Al-Qaeda, and
that's
Mahfouz
correct.
Was also working with the Carlyle group, which...
George Bush brought him into, brought those guys into the Carlyle group.
George Bush Sr.
Yeah.
So George Bush brought a guy... And I'll read it on air. We'll be right back.
Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Laura Miller.
On the heels of a record-setting sex discrimination lawsuit against Walmart, the lawyers in that case have filed a second discrimination suit, this time against Costco Wholesale Corporation. The suit, filed on Tuesday, alleges that the company kept women out of top store management posts. According to the complainant, women make up half of the company's workforce, but fewer than 1 in 6 of Costco's top store managers are women. Costco's annual staff turnover is under 23% among hourly workers, while Walmart's is 50%. The company has been criticized by stockholders because it offers better pay and benefits than Walmart, creating higher costs.
Many people are excited about the Olympic Games being held in Athens this week, but city officials are putting the homeless and workers in last place. According to a report by Amnesty International, up to 40 construction workers died due to poor safety standards during the construction of Olympic facilities. Amnesty International also reports that Athens officials are attempting to clean up the city by rounding up homeless, drug-addicted, and mentally ill people and locking them in psychiatric hospitals until international tourists leave. Also, the government has suspended authorizing inmate parole at 6 of the country's prisons.
The majority of customer service representatives at America West have voted to join the Teamsters. The Phoenix-based airline said it was disappointed by the outcome, but said it will respect the decision of its employees. Until the vote on Tuesday, the customer service workers were the only segment of the airline not represented by a union.
Like all workers, baseball players try to avoid a strike, but in an effort to maintain a two-league system and prevent mergers, Japanese pro baseball players voted overwhelmingly to obtain strike rights. 98% of union members in Japan's Professional Baseball Players Association voted in favor. Preparations are currently underway to strike if several Pacific League teams continue with plans to merge. The Japan Trade Union Confederation pledged to support any strike action by the baseball players.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Want to take half of the year off from work? Move to Norway. A Norwegian paper recently reported that the amount of time workers are absent from work per year was more than 170 days. The average amount of sick days used by Norwegians amounts to more than 4 weeks. Throw in the average 5 weeks of vacation time, 11 national paid holidays and weekends, and it turns out Norwegians are absent nearly half of the calendar year. The chronic absenteeism has become such a problem that the government now requires a doctor's note for anyone who misses 8 weeks in a year.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington. My guest is Mark Umeli. He is the author of Bush Unplugged, A True Patriot's Guide to George W. Bush. You can find information about the book at his website, www.bushunplugged.com. I know you can buy the book at Amazon and at bookstores everywhere. If you want to call in, all you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can comment on the blog, and I'm going to be reading some of those comments in just a few minutes. Before we took a break, we were talking about the ties between the Bush family and actually Osama bin Laden. Now, this sounds like conspiracy stuff. This sounds like, you know, crazy Michael Moore stuff, and yet Mark Umeli says that in his book, he can document how it is that George Bush Sr. brought a guy into his company that gave $30 million to Al-Qaeda, a guy named bin Mahfouz. Mark, explain the connection to us.
Okay. George Bush Sr. Was working for the Carlyle Group, traveling around the Middle East, and he brought in a few of these characters. One of the groups he brought in was the Saudi bin Laden group. Now, the Bin Laden Group is a big construction firm, and they were also known as a founding member of a group called the Golden Chain, a group of wealthy Saudis that provided al-Qaeda with its startup funds in the late 80s. That's one thing. Now, Bin Mahfouz's two sons were, I can't even say their names, they're long Arab names. George Bush lobbied, brought these guys as investors into the Carlyle Group, one of the largest private equity firms in the world, big defense contractor, maker of fighter jets. Now, the eldest Bin Mahfouz's son was later a debt. Now, they kicked in, the sons kicked $30 million into Carlyle's coffers. That's where the $30 million comes in. Bin Mahfouz's son was later identified as...
So wait, just a second. So it's Mahfouz's group kicking $30 million into...
To the Carlyle Group.
Into Bush's company, the Carlyle Group.
That's right.
But
and
they also gave $30 million to Bin Laden.
No.
All right, I want to get that straight.
You got to correct you.
All right.
His two sons are brought into the Carlyle Group by Bush Sr.
Got it.
The eldest son was later identified as director of a group called the Muwafaqa Foundation.
Okay.
One of several Islamic charities designated by the U.S. Treasury as a front operation shifting funds to al-Qaeda. That's the U.S. Treasury. That's not conspiracy.
When did the U.S. Treasury denote this? When did they say
I think it was the early 90s. All of this information came out of the Wall Street Journal, by the way.
Wow. And it's gotten virtually no press. I mean, nobody's talking about it except you and me.
Okay. Now, the elder Bin Mahfouz, Khalid Bin Mahfouz, in the mid-70s, he came to Texas, and Michael Moore talks about this, but he doesn't go into it all the way. He doesn't make the connection. He came to Texas with Bin Laden's older brother looking to make political and business contacts in Texas, of all places. Well, Bin Mahfouz and Bin Laden's brother, they hired a guy named James Bath to act as their intermediary between themselves and the Houston businessmen. Well, this Khalid Bin Mahfouz was later identified James Bath made investments in George Bush's first company, Arbusto. And in 1991, Time magazine said that Bath made those investments for his Saudi clients in his own name in exchange for a percentage of the deals. So by one degree of separation, you could talk about Bin Mahfouz and George Bush Jr. also. And nobody wants to talk about that because it's very dangerous. Now, I bring this up because they're documented fact. However, do I say that Bush Sr. knew that I'm sure they had no idea they were giving money to Islamic charity.
No, I'm sure, but the incompetence and the idea that you're going to just deal with anybody who gives you money, you don't look into their background.
That's right.
It's pretty extraordinary. Let me read a comment here. I've got a whole list of comments. I want to read some of them on the air. This is a comment, Brian from New Jersey. He writes, Michael Moore, as much as I hate him for sugarcoating too many key issues in all his movies, said it best. King George the W is getting millions of dollars from foreign oil. He gets a couple $100,000 as president of the United States. Actually, it's $400,000 now, Brian. In effect, Brian writes, who matters more to W? I'm sorry, this may be an unpatriotic view of my president, but money is power. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's scary to think, Brian writes, that the Saudis are running my country. Would you go that far, Mark? I mean, are the Saudis really helping to run our country?
They're not running the country. The Saudis own about 7% of the United States. And I'm right on the same page with your caller from New Jersey. That's exactly why I wrote the book, and I try to make all of those connections from A to Z. And I think I've done that more effectively than most of these other Bush books out there. The fact is that the Saudis are the number one funders of Islamic terrorism as we know it. They've given millions, if not billions, to, when you add it all up, to al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, and a couple of other organizations that I talk about in the book. And yet, in the wake of, we know that Saudi money funded the 9/11 attackers. We know they gave billions to all these. And yet,
and 15 of the 19 were Saudis.
Mentions the Saudi Arabians in the terrorist equation.
No, they even allowed them to fly out right after 9/11.
So when you look at these connections that I talk about in the book, and Michael Moore talks about somewhat in his movie, you see the reasons why. And then you can throw into that, look, Dick Cheney's Halliburton's been making hundreds of millions of dollars in Saudi Arabia. Chevron Texaco.
Doesn't the Carlyle Group also do defense? Don't they make a lot of
money? Carlyle Group's got billion-dollar investments military investments and military deals going, defense deals going on with the Saudis.
Let me read some more of these emails that I've gotten. Here's one from Rick. He writes, the Bushes doing business with terrorists? Who would have thought? The Bushes don't care who they do business with. Terrorists, criminals, rogue states, as long as they make a buck, What's stopping them from selling out America? Nothing. Rick writes, I'm glad to hear your guest talk about this. I've heard of him, though I've never had a chance to listen to him speak. Well, Rick, I'm very glad to bring Mark Umeli on the air. I hope you'll check out his book. I got another comment, and this write, this person writes, great, I feel so secure that we have a drunk, cokehead, illiterate, moronic greedmonger as president. I thought it was weird having a wrestler as governor. I think Republicans misspeak when they say he's a man with character. The right thing to say is that he's a character. This pattern of behavior speaks a lot about the type of person this Yahoo really is. He must be proud the history books will record him as the worst president in American history. Well, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. I want to ask, though, we've talked about this connection. I want to move on to talk about something else, and that is the insider trading scandal, because people have started to just now, I think, to understand it with Martha Stewart. What did George Bush do compared to what Martha Stewart did, and which do you think is a worse crime?
Well, it's four times worse in George Bush's case. Listen, he was on the board of Harkin Energy, and the whole time he was on the board, he really wasn't doing anything in Harkin. He was working for his dad's election bid. He was working for his father. However, he was assigned to something called a Fairness Committee at Harkin, and the Fairness Committee was basically put together to evaluate the stock performance.
Okay.
Coming into the summer of 1990, Saddam is threatening to invade Iraq, invade Kuwait, which we know will drop, will send oil crisis, oil prices plummeting. Also, Harkin was about to lose. Harkin was going to report they've lost 25% of their the company was in big trouble because they weren't finding. Believe it or not, they didn't even find oil in Bahrain. So there's no question about it that Bush had to know. In the nick of time, he dumps three-quarters of his Harkin
stock. As I recall, one second, wasn't he given a letter by either lawyers or accountants telling him that the company was about to go bust and not pay its debts?
That's never been documented.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Okay, I just talk about what we know.
All right.
The fact that he was on this Fairness Committee, there's just no question that he was. He was evaluating the stock performance. Okay. It, right in the nick of time, right before they're about to announce their quarterlies, Bush sells out to the tune of almost $900,000.
And I think just two, 3 weeks later, the stock tanks, right?
That's right. Two, 3 weeks later, the stock tanks. And then Saddam invades, and the stock goes down another 25%. Now, we also know that he had to know, that his dad knew that Saddam was going to invade. Saddam told the American government, he told April Gillespie at the time,
yep,
that he was going to invade, and she basically gave him the green light.
Yeah, she said, we have no interest in your border dispute with
That's
Kuwait.
That's exactly.
Oops.
Right.
Oops.
Let me
ask you, I got another email here. This emailer writes, wants to know if you put a chart in your book, because all these links between the Bushes and their business partners are so numerous and complicated it's hard to keep track. Do you have any charts, any diagrams, things like that?
No, but I do address his question. What I do is I explain it all in a language that I believe all Americans can relate to and understand. I try to put the puzzles together in such a way that anybody can look at it and go, okay, that makes total sense. I back it up with sources like the Wall Street Journal, and Newsweek, Time Magazine, that all reported on this stuff. And I link it all together in a way that you just go, oh, okay, I get it.
Okay, let me just ask you one last... Fair enough.
Okay.
We only got about 6 minutes left. I'll tell you, time really flies. We're talking about this topic. This hour has just flew. I do want to ask you about Enron, because I know that Ken Lay, who George Bush called Kenny Boy, wasn't he the CEO of Enron, wasn't he the leading campaign contributor to Bush's?
He was the leading campaign.
He gave a million dollars.
All-time number one personal donor.
That's what I thought.
The time Bush ran for governor in Texas in 94. All the way up to 2000. Enron was also the all-time leading donor up to George W. Bush, and George W. Bush was the all-time leading recipient of Enron cash.
Okay,
and
that's the
Enron
quid.
Get their money's worth.
Got it. That's the quid. Now, in the quid pro quo, what's the quo? What did Enron get back for all the money it gave to George W. Bush?
Well, when he was governor of Texas, he basically allowed Ken Lay to come in and help him rewrite Texas energy and environmental law, tax law, in the state of Texas. And I go into that in a book, but since we have less time, I'll tell you the most egregious thing that happened.
Okay.
When George Bush became president, he brought Ken Lay, this kills me about these Democrats, he brought Ken Lay onto his transition team. And Ken Lay and some of the other transition team monkeys got together and they stacked and packed the Bush administration with former Enron employees, shareholders, and executives at the highest levels all the way down through the administration, tax, and all these
companies, all these positions would affect our tax, trade, energy, and environmental policies. Ken Lay was in the Secret Energy Task Force, and he was instrumental in forming that entire policy. And yet the Democrats don't touch this stuff. It's just
I think part of it is that on this show we have an hour. We can actually explore all the details here. I mean, even then, your book obviously can explore in much more detail than we can in an hour. But I think that this is the kind of thing you can't put in a 30-second soundbite, and that's about all the media will take right now.
I think you can. By the way,
yeah. Okay, give me your 30-second soundbite.
If anybody wants to get more info on the book, they can go to BushUnplugged.com. I can write a 30-second spot that can bullet point, and I'm trying to get to these Democrats, man, or MoveOn.org.
I'll tell you what.
A 30-second spot about the things that will just burn Americans to the crawl.
I'll tell you what, Mark, I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm going to give you about 30 seconds, maybe a full minute. Give me your last one-minute pitch. If you could do a one-minute commercial, what would it say?
I would take I would draw a through line from George Bush's days in the oil field all the way to the mother of all oil reserves in Iraq. I would bullet point, if I had a minute, I would bullet point the connections that he made, how he rose to power, who he brought with him to the presidency, how he's been tied to big energy. That's a big part of my thesis. Bush's ties to oil, gas, coal, the electric utility industries, the nuclear industry. These are, when you start to get it, you put the picture together, you see the money connections, you understand why we are fighting two wars in the two most oil and gas regions, two most oil and gas rich regions in the world. And it explains a lot about the war on terror when you frame it in that perspective.
Well, Mark Umeli, you've been a terrific guest. As I said, this hour has really flown by. I want to thank you very much for coming on the Inside Scoop and encourage listeners to go to your website, www.bushunplugged.com, and pick up a copy of your book.
Can I say one thing to you, Mark?
Yes.
On November 3rd, we're probably going to have some more electoral shenanigans that needs to be uncovered, and I hope you will go forth and do the same thing that you did in the wake of the first election, because it made a lot of difference for a lot of people.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Mark. Thank you very much.
I am, as
my regular listeners know, very much concerned about the election, concerned about the election shenanigans, and I did fight very hard in 2000, including even write the brief for the Congressional Black Caucus challenging the Florida electors. So thank you for that plug, if you will, by Bush Unplugged author Mark Umeli. You know, it's interesting. I'll just read one last comment I have on the blog by James. He writes about a new party game that we should try. Instead of 6 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon, we should start playing a game where we try to link Bush to an organization that funds terrorists in under six hops. James, we could play Name That Tune. I think I could do it in four. It's a great game. Look, let me tell you why this matters in the last minute or half I have. And I understand listeners that say, you know, that's all in the past. Let's focus on what they'll do for the future. We certainly should focus on what Bush and Kerry will do for the future. Absolutely. That's why I always encourage people, go to www.johnkerry.com, see his proposals. But one of the things I think that can go under the radar, if you don't catch it, when John Kerry stood up there and he gave his acceptance speech and he said, I don't want an America that's dictated by the Saudis. The best way, really, to attack Bush, to get us weaned off foreign oil. Foreign oil is the reason we're in Iraq. Foreign oil is the reason why Bush is buddy-buddies with the Saudi Arabia. And it's not that we can't do it, folks. I have ridden myself in a car that's based on soybeans alone. Jimmy Carter, back in the 1970s, talked about weaning this nation off of foreign oil. We would not have to do what the Arab sheiks tell us to do, we wouldn't be attacked and hated all around the world if we would just start using alternative energy. So I have to say, I do think that if you want to understand George W. Bush, you can look well or just look at 3OIL. This is the administration of oil, for oil, by oil. And I hope, as Mark Umeli says, that November 3rd we can get rid of any election shenanigans and actually elect a new president not controlled by oil interests. Of course, that's John Kerry. And tune in tomorrow. We're going to have a very interesting show. We're actually going to go over tomorrow. It'll be about 90 minutes. We're going to play the full debate on June 30th, 1971 on the Dick Cavett Show between 27-year-old John Kerry and 25-year-old John O'Neill. John O'Neill, who was sent to this debate, to debate John Kerry by none other than President Richard Nixon, sat with him for an hour, gave him all his talking points. John O'Neill is the same person who 33 years later, wrote the screed against John Kerry about Swift Boat veterans. There's just an article in the Washington Post today talking about how that's a lie. You will want to hear this debate between these two youngsters, because just as we've learned from George W. Bush's past, this is a guy who's gotten everything that he could ever want from his daddy's friends and expects just to get everything he can want. You know, just go into Iraq, we get it. Just as we've learned from Bush's past, we can also learn from John Kerry's past, and you won't want to miss tomorrow's show when we listen to the words of this quite thoughtful young man under the vicious attacks of John O'Neill. You won't want to miss tomorrow's show, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, but we got to go for now. This is Mark Levine signing off.